Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. We've got a great show in store for you today. You will find out why very quickly. But before that, a little bit of housekeeping. We would love for you to review the show on iTunes or Stitcher. We read every review that you write. Let us know who you'd like to hear on the show, topics you'd love us to cover, etc. We've been super busy at Cherry Bomb we're always busy, but super busy lately because we just announced our Jubilee Conference in San Francisco. It's our first West Coast Jubilee, and Alice Waters is our keynote speaker, and we are very, very excited and still kind of can't believe it. You know, when you book somebody like that, you always just think, wow, is this really going to happen? But it is, kids, October 14th in San Francisco. Tickets are on sale right now at cherrybomb.com. And we have so many amazing people who are speaking at this conference. We'll be announcing more and more of them as the days and weeks go on. You can also check out Eater San Francisco for a peek at some of the folks who will be speaking. What else is going on? We're making plans for our cookbook tour. We'll be announcing that pretty soon. The book is out October 10th, and it is more than 100 recipes from 100 plus of our favorite members of the Bomb Squad, so you will want to check that out. We're not announcing the tour dates just yet, but I'll give you one date because we're really excited about this, and it's probably going to be the first date on the tour. But we will be at Books Are Magic on October 6th. That's my friend Emma Straub's bookstore in Brooklyn. I love that place. I probably go there once a week and buy a book. So mark your calendars, October 6th. We would love, 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 love to see you there. All right, what else do we have to talk about? Our sponsors. We love our sponsors. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is presented by our friends at Le Cordon Bleu. Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school, has locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from nine-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. You can visit cordonbleu.edu for more. Regular listeners know we did a little contest with Le Cordon Bleu, and we will be announcing the winner of that pretty soon. She has been notified, and she is very pumped and is picking which city she's going to go to for classes. Also, if you care about the food your pets eat, you need to know about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients from Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food. It's purposeful pet food at its best. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. You know, I was scrolling through Instagram on the train ride here, you know, as I often do, and I saw that Castor and Pollux is donating a lot of pet food to some of the relief efforts down in Houston, and I was really happy to see that. And speaking of which, we spoke to Rebecca Masson last week from Fluff Bake Bar in Houston, and she fortunately has her bakery back up and running. And Rebecca gave us a list of local organizations that you can help out. A lot of you asked for links to those, and if we could repeat them, if you go to our website and look up the episode with Rebecca and Katie Quinn and Ashley Stanley, you will see a list there with links. There were groups like Houston Pet Set at HoustonPetSet.org, the Rescued Pets Movement, TexasChildrens.org, and then she also mentioned some of the schools that could use some help. So be sure to check that out on CherryBomb.com. All right, now the fun stuff. We get to talk to our first guests. We are super lucky that we are in the studio today with two folks from Roads and Kingdoms, one of my favorite. I don't want to call you a site. You guys are so much more than a site. But we are here with Kara Parks and Nathan Thornburg of Roads and Kingdoms. Welcome you two to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
As I lose my voice, I'm so excited that you're here.
We'll take it from here.
we were talking to our engineer, Dave, a little earlier, and when we told him who our guests were, he was like, is that like some kind of Game of Thrones thing? And why do people think that? Is it all the majestic photos that you have?
I think it's
on
all
the
anybody
website?
Can think about these days.
Is Game of Thrones?
I haven't caught up yet, so no spoilers, please.
Okay, don't worry. I don't watch Game of Thrones, and I'm embarrassed to even admit that, but there are just so many shows, and you can't keep up with all of them.
I don't watch Game of Thrones.
You don't, Dave?
No.
Okay. So my boyfriend does, and he was trying to catch up, and he said, but I don't want to watch it in front of you. And I said, oh, I don't care. I'll watch it. And he could not believe that I would watch something out of sequence. But it's so in the air, Game of Thrones. I feel like even if you don't watch it, you know all about it. I know what the Red Wedding is. I know. I tuned into HBO early one night to watch Girls. And there was that horrific episode where the queen walks down the stairs naked and everyone is screaming at her. And then there's the skeleton army.
Wait, that was Girls.
And I was like, what the hell? I was like, what the hell is this? So anyway, you don't really even have to watch Game of Thrones to know what's going on Game of Thrones. Mother of Dragons, all that stuff.
You've saved yourself a lot of time. Congratulations.
I disagree. It's an amazing show.
I know. I will catch up eventually, but, you know, it's been, what can I say? It's been a busy few years, as it has for you two. So give us the elevator pitch. What is Roads and Kingdoms?
Roads and Kingdoms started as a meeting, a smoked goat and beer hall night outside of Mexico City where I met Matt Goulding. I was coming from Time Magazine where I was a foreign correspondent, had done a lot of like post-conflict stories and a lot of kind of like drier geopolitical reporting. And Matt was in Mexico doing a story called There Are No Nachos in Mexico. It's like 6 weeks of just like eating his face off from north to south. And I was getting ready to leave Time anyway. The long decline had already started and I was looking for something new. And I think Matt was interested in ideas that were kind of off the plate a little bit. The guy's a fucking talented writer and thinker and wanted a bigger canvas on some level. So at its heart, it's still that, you know, it is that combination of like politics and food, trying to combine these things that people think might make uneasy bedfellows, but actually tend to live pretty well and pretty richly together. So when we started to expand the team, you know, there's a reason why Kara's sitting here, and she was like just made to take Roads and Kingdoms to the next level because her background was that she had been a baker, and then she had worked at Foreign Policy, and then she worked at Modern Farmer, and just had that combination of having worked in hospitality, knowing about food, caring about it, but also being incredibly engaged in the rest of the wider world. And that's, you know, so that's the DNA from the very beginning. That was like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago now, to today, and hopefully well into the future. That's all it is. Just like, let's use food to talk about, you know, some real shit.
And Kara, you're the executive editor. Nathan, you are the CEO. Nathan also said you are the, what, I heard you whispering, you were like, you are the bedrock of, of Roads and Kingdoms.
Kara is the rock. She
you said
writes.
You said the badass rock. That is what you said.
The badass, yeah. Yeah. Might have been fumbling there a little bit. She's both a badass and the rock of Roads and Kingdoms. But, you know, if you spend time around the site, you will hear her voice, not just in the editing, but also, you know, she has an amazing travel column, which is just one of my favorite reads ever. And she does our newsletters, and she also leads the editorial team. So, you know, the DNA is very much intertwined with Kara. And I don't mean to make you blush. She's actually sitting right here. But I was just telling her on a smoke break how incredibly fortunate we are to have that, because it's not everybody who's got that kind of that background mm-hmm. that can combine both of those things and do them so incredibly, credibly.
So, Kara, Roads and Kingdoms is way more than just a site today. Tell us what else is under the Roads and Kingdoms umbrella.
Yeah, so in addition to the site, which is we do publish daily, we also do event series. We've recently been doing a number of dinners based around the Muslim majority banned countries. Our most recent one was last month and was a huge success. We've gone through Syria, we've gone through Syria, Iran. We did a Nauru celebration, and those have been extremely popular. We also do an ongoing series called Journalism and Drinks. It's very literally titled. And we have foreign correspondents come in. We, you know, have a few beers, and we talk about that reporting world and how they're operating, how they've gotten to the point in their career that they've reached. And that's also been a really, it's just been great getting to get all those people in a room. We've met a lot of really wonderful foreign correspondents that way. And in addition, we do work. We are just wrapping a video series. We are launching a podcast. We do work very closely with Anthony Bourdain on a lot of his projects. So it's been a very busy couple of years, definitely.
And you have those beautiful books.
We have those beautiful books.
I'm very jealous every time a new one comes out.
Yeah, they are, you know, they're really the life's work at this point of Matt Goulding, my co-founder. And what he does is he's been going country by country. Started with Japan, launched Spain, Italy's coming next, and basically finds like the 7 to 9 best eating places that you can go as a traveler. But what he does is he does basically a New Yorker piece from each place, both in length and quality and depth and in heart. It's this incredible work of finding the people behind the food, stories about families and love and life and death, and also the cuisine that kind of winds through it all. And that's how we started with Bourdain, actually. Matt was in Japan getting behind curtains that in all of my time in Japan, which I had spent quite a bit, I'd never gotten access to the rooms he got access to just as a cook, you know, as somebody who could talk food and find a way into the lives of people there. So we sent an email to Bourdain and said, listen, there's like really interesting stuff happening here. And he emailed, as he does, from his iPad immediately. I was like, yes, let's do a book. And that was the start of the whole process that ended up him being a partner and investor in Roads and Kingdoms. So,
is it true the email was sent when you guys were drunk? Did I read that somewhere?
Yeah, that was a fantastic Bloomberg headline or something, and somebody had mocked up a little like Snapchatty thing with like a bottle of rum and Bourdain looking blasted on some steps somewhere.
Because I think tonight I'm going to drunk dial Ina Garten or Martha Stewart or Ruth Reichel. One of them.
Yeah.
They'll take the call.
Yeah. Matt is a warrior. I have drunken a lot with him. I've never seen him actually drunk. I would be very surprised if that email had come off when he had done that. But he was in Japan. What are you going to do? He's like, it was late. He was having sake. I think maybe there was a little liquid courage there. But
whatever it takes, right?
Exactly. Whatever it takes to email him.
I'm super curious about, you guys are legit journalists. And I don't want to say that food writers aren't legit journalists, but you've been a war correspondent. How do you feel now that you're in this sort of interesting, you're lumped a little bit into the food media?
Feels great. We also do, we sort of see ourselves or are oftentimes kind of placed in travel media as a concept. That doesn't bum me out. What it does is make you realize how much opportunity there is out there. There's something that's been a secret to our longevity so far and the audience that we have. It's that, the rest of media, and that's hard news, that's politics, it's food, it's travel, has become something of a pig lagoon. And that is not
a pig lagoon. I don't even know what that means.
That's the place where they collect the feces from the big pig farms. This is not a compliment I'm working on here. It's just that there are so few places, and Cherry Bomb's one of them. That's why we're psyched to be here. But like, there's few places that actually really give a shit about what they do, and that's that has helped us immeasurably, mm-hmm. just to stand out, not by doing anything extraordinary on some level, but just by caring about the work that we do, it's right.
We talk about that. We just redesigned our website all by ourselves, which we're very proud of, and I was like, let's put our mission statement on the site, because I never worked anywhere that had a mission statement before, and we do. It's supporting women in food, and is it something you guys talk about? Does everybody know what your mission/mission statement is?
Yeah, I think that people understand that, you know, there's a growing awareness of how political the food world really is and how complicated these systems are, that they're tied up with economics, politics, culture, travel, all of that. And I think that people realize when they come to Roads and Kingdoms that that's the perspective we're coming from, that these are serious issues that deserve real journalistic intent. And, you know, we have people writing for us from around the world who have a unique perspective on how these cultural shifts are playing out. And I think that that's something our audience really appreciates.
It's been a painful year on so many fronts, but I do think waking everybody up to food is political and that you can't separate the two has been an important lesson for all of us to learn.
Absolutely. I think especially, you know, in the last few months, we've taken a lot of comfort from being able to connect with our both our contributors and our audience over this shared search for ways of processing everything that's been going on politically. You know, it's been one long nightmare. And I think that, you know, we have found a community that really matters to us, and it's been extremely helpful.
Yeah, it's been, as for everybody, it's both a public and a personal catastrophe on a lot of levels. I don't think hurricane season has helped much with that either, but it does feel like, you know, you just have to look for answers. And the Journalism and Drinks things we do have always been a fundraiser for MSF, the dinner series that we did raising money for various refugee foundations and causes. It's a little thing, mm-hmm. but you got to start somewhere. And I think for us, you know, as it should be for people who work in any field, it's like, okay, well, how do we do what we do best and try to point it in a direction that's going to be helpful? Just the act of being who we are in this room, I think thinking and caring about the things we do, working with the writers that we do from around the world who are actually from the cultures that they're writing about, those things themselves are very political acts also. So it doesn't always have to be overt, but there's always more we can do. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, you know, shit is still wicked broken and who knows, you know, who's going to be able to fix it, but you do have to just take a first step.
Yeah. I mean, that would be my, I guess, main knock against the general food media is that you really, it's easy for people to get so caught up in the silliness and the superficial and not ever have to think who or what is behind, you know, in the kitchen at the restaurant that you love, who is picking the fruit, who is doing this or that. And I don't know. It's great that there's that awareness now. Will you continue to do those dinners?
Yes, we are continuing on. We are planning the next one for the fall. We don't have a date selected yet, but it is upcoming.
But we'll find those on your site. And you have a podcast launching in October, as you kind of alluded to. What's your podcast going to be?
So the podcast is called The Trip. It is hosted by me with Kara, and then also Anthony Bourdain is involved, so he'll be on the shows as well. We are really excited about it because it gives us a chance to take a look at some of our favorite stories and some of our favorite writers, but from an audio perspective. So there's a lot of some amazing sound design and just like a full immersive treatment that you can't really do with the written word in quite the same way and is unique even from the video projects that we do. So essentially every episode we're going to go behind, you know, kind of one of the most gripping stories that we've been able to run recently and bring that writer into the studio, talk them through their experience, like why it mattered to them, why it should matter to readers, and then basically present a kind of beautiful audio version of that story. So I'm incredibly excited about it. Something I've been wanting us to do for a long time. And you know, we have the good fortune, I think, with Bourdain as our you know, kind of leader in this, to be able to have opportunities to do those things now. And I can't wait.
Podcasts are fun.
I'm having fun right now.
Yes. So, Kara, I heard you went to Myanmar recently.
Yes.
When were you there?
I was just there a couple of weeks ago, actually, in Yangon. And it was an absolutely fantastic trip. I met some really wonderful people, some tea leaf growers and producers. We were out there with Chef Desmond Tan of Burma Superstar in the Bay Area. And it was just a really wonderful experience and amazing food.
I love Burmese food. Fermented tea leaves, though, I feel like since I've never been to Myanmar, I've never had an authentic fermented tea leaf. I'm guessing you ate a lot of those.
A lot of those, yes.
Tell us about the food.
Fermented tea leaf salad is served a lot as a sort of welcoming dish when someone's visiting a home. And so we were lucky to be able to have a lunch at a friend's house in Yangon, and we were able to eat this amazing salad. The tea leaves are mostly grown in Shan State, and they are pretty particular to Burma, and they are served as a salad with peanuts, sesame seeds, dried shrimp, it's like raw garlic. It's a really flavorful dish with lots of different textures. And the tea leaves have a very, as you might imagine, aromatic and a little bit of a almost sour flavor. They can be flavored in different ways, but it's absolutely delicious. I was also very lucky to have an amazing breakfast of mutton bone curry that was fantastic, with super fresh, just like right out of the grill naan. And basically everything we ate was amazing.
Yeah. So I listen to the BBC every morning, and you just hear every day about the unrest in Myanmar. Was that really visible where you traveled to there?
So we were in Yangon, which is not really part of that. The producers we were talking to, who are based in Shan State, were dealing with violence constantly. They were making sort of black humor jokes about making sure their outfits wouldn't attract the attention of snipers as they were just going through their farms. They're having trouble getting enough farm labor to produce the tea leaves. And I actually left a day before the violence in Rakhine State started in earnest. And there's now basically a full-on ethnic cleansing program going on there. So that's been extremely disappointing. And the political response from the government has just been beyond dismal. It was even at one point, there's, you know, terms like fake news being thrown out, and it's really horrible to watch. I know that a lot of the people I talked to there felt that they were at a real moment of transition, that the opening up over the last 5 years has been huge. The explosive use of the internet has completely changed how people live, but at the same time, it has opened up ethnic tensions that were sort of sublimated previously.
And Nathan, you're no stranger to visiting places like that.
Well, our first trip actually that Matt and I took together to kind of road test this idea of Roads and Kingdoms was in Myanmar. It was right at the time that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came, which was a pretty historic visit. Matt stayed in Yangon and did a lot of work around food, and we were with Naomi Duguid, who wrote this Rivers of Flavor, which is an amazing cookbook out of Myanmar. But I went up to Michina in Kachin State in the north, which, I mean, like all of these kind of ethnic states, was at a, you know, in a state of low-level warfare against the Burma people, the Burma government. You know, as a Christian ethnic minority, they were constantly sort of being targeted or launching their own attacks. It was the first place I had ever heard people say, don't trust Aung San Suu Kyi. Like, we loved her father, but this woman, you know, could be dangerous, which made zero sense. Like, you might as well have said that about Gandhi from what I had known and thought about her. They unfortunately seem to be proven right these days. It's a very very troubling to just see her allow these things to happen, because she is, you know, an absolute leader morally of that country. And you know, listen, who are we to throw stones right now? We've got some
Great
of our
point.
Own
Great
problems
point.
At home, but disappointing is definitely a word for it.
Yeah, one person there described it to me as, it's not the Buddhism you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be panning out.
So let's talk about being part of the indie media for a little while, because that ain't easy these days.
No.
So you come from Time, big machine.
The most corporate of all the news magazines, which was not their official slogan, but that is definitely what it was.
So how's it different on the indie side?
I still have the fire for this way of doing media. I mean, it's been a few years now, right? We've started five and a half years ago. But I think Matt also had the same thing. He had written Eat This, Not That, which was about as accessible.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, he was a co-author of that. I mean, actually, he...
For those who don't know that, it's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Eat This, Not That.
Yeah.
And it's all about health and fitness and weight and all that.
Yeah, it started as a section in the front of the book at Men's Health where he had been working, and they turned it in. And it's like basically the premise is if you're stuck in an Applebee's, like, you know, you have to have like the fajita chicken salad or the like Cajun, you know, poppers, you know, so like which one of those is going to kill you quicker? And then they'll give you it's a very blisteringly colorful handheld compact guide to that. Anyway, they sold a bajillion of those books. It was essentially the Time magazine experience for him in the sense that you're like performing for this massive audience, but doing it in a way that doesn't really speak to you or what your goals and really what your personality is. So those experiences were defining enough for us that all of the indignities of indie media, which, you know, I don't have to describe to you at any length. It's like you do great stuff and then you realize that BuzzFeed has, you know, in the last, you know, 30 seconds garnered more views than, you know, any of our puny efforts ever will. It doesn't matter. Like, we're doing this for ourselves first and foremost, and for those people who have found us and care about us and know what we do. And that gets me through all the other junk.
So let's talk about the magical part of Roads and Kingdoms, as we kind of alluded to earlier when we mentioned Game of Thrones. You write about just these beautiful, magical places. What are... Tell me a place that's beautiful and magical that Roads and Kingdoms has looked at. Putting you on the spot. Carrie, you can answer too.
Well, I was actually also just in Hanoi, and I had a fantastic time there. And I think we've done some really beautiful pieces from Vietnam. And I actually think that country of Georgia has gotten a completely disproportionate amount of play on Roads and Kingdoms.
We do have our hot spots.
That seems to be somewhere we cover a lot, and it is gorgeous.
You do have great Vietnam coverage. I subscribed to your newsletter, and I love it. And you had, I think it was a Vietnamese breakfast story a few weeks ago, or last week maybe, and it was all this stuff I didn't know, and I like to think I know a fair amount about Vietnam, but Hanoi, I second that. Vietnam in general is just such a wonderful place to visit. Best food, I think, in the world.
And the food is spectacular,
and the people are really nice. I don't think they go out of their way to like be super duper tourist friendly, but I know when I tell people about my travels there, they always assume there's some level of hostility. There is no hostility. They more don't care.
Yeah. No, I don't think that there is.
They're either nice or they don't care.
They're busy.
Yeah.
They're hustlers.
They are.
Yeah.
The women are hustlers.
Yeah.
One thing that surprised me about that piece that you wrote, it was a lot of guys. It was a lot of like what guys are doing food-wise over in Vietnam. But my experience is so many of these restaurants and markets and just street stalls are run by women. Yeah. You almost see no men doing the food stuff over there.
Yeah, I was working with a local journalist, Trang Bui, and she was absolutely fantastic. She's really involved in the food world, and we did end up working with a male chef there, but we were going to a lot of just the most amazing places, and there were a lot of women in the kitchens.
Mm-hmm. Made me wonder, I've never asked anyone over there, but if it's not manly to work in food in Vietnam, because it is striking how many women you see. We'll uncover that for a different show. But all right, Nathan, your turn. Just a beautiful place you've been to.
I mean, listen, I'm desperately in love with the Republic of Georgia, which may have something to do with
the
reasons. I may be responsible for this. I mean, I was in Kahetty the last, you know, kind of free vacation time where it's like not doing anything. That's kind of where I wanted to go and just kind of unwind. I will say the idea of a perfect magical place for us always involves the kind of you know, the truth in travel that I think you don't really get from a lot of places. The fact is, there are assholes everywhere on Earth. There's food anywhere you go. And if you tease that out and make, you know, and wind that into the part of the story, then you start to gain credibility with the readers who will understand that you cannot escape yourself and your own problems and your own demons just by going somewhere, just finding a postcard scenery. But if you deal with people as people and you get through these experiences and make it to that amazing, you know, that amazing grandmother who's got, you know, like 200 years worth of grain alcohol under her living room floor or whatever, then you are going to have what I would broadly categorize as a magical experience. But it for us, it's very important to never romanticize too much and enjoy the world as it actually is, which is actually, you know what, pretty fucking magical.
I want to know more about that grandmother, but I'm going to save that for a different show. Thank you, too, for stopping by. It's super nice to see you in person. We love these folks. We love Roads and Kingdoms, and we would love all our listeners to support them and check out their website, check out their books, stay tuned for their podcast, subscribe to their newsletter, do all those good things to support our friends over at Roads and Kingdoms.
Back at you. Feeling is mutual. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you, too, for stopping by.
Thank you.
We will take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu. for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donnie Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do. And as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. For our next installment, we are going to hear an interview with our British Bomb Squad correspondent, Hester Cant. She produced this piece while still in the States. We miss you very much, Hester. Keep listening as we take your senses aboard Swale. That's S-W-A-L-E, the floating food forest that has since made its way to a pier in the Bronx. Founded in 2016 by artist Mary Mattingly, Swale offers educational programming and welcomes visitors to harvest herbs, or as Hester says, herbs, fruits and vegetables for free. So hop aboard the barge with Hester and her guests, Lindsay Grothkopp and Marissa Preffer.
I just had the thought, I'm like, wow, we're like a little commune. I looked around at all of us just here I am, just standing. And then no one else is here, we're just happily weeding.
This is our life. This is how we live. That's how I live. I don't know.
I'm Lindsay Grothkopp. I do communications and external affairs for Swale.
My name is Marissa Preffer, and I am the permaculture operations manager and also school programs manager and public programs manager and, depending on the day, a number of other things.
We are here on a 140 by 50 foot barge that used to be used for hauling sand that has now been converted into a forest garden full of edible medicinal plants. We welcome the public on board 4 days a week to learn about the plants, to try them, to take them home, and to engage with their landscape in a new way.
So right now we are staring at a hill planted full of native apple trees. We can also see lots of berries, blueberries, coming into bloom. There are plenty of herbaceous perennials that are ripe for the picking. Lots of culinary, medicinal herbs, also plants that are useful for pollinators, so bees, butterflies, birds.
Mm-hmm. We're here in Brooklyn Bridge Park, Pier 6, looking at the Lower Manhattan skyline. Pretty prime location. We've been here for about 2 months, and then on Friday we're moving up to the Bronx to Concrete Plant Park, which is actually where we started the project in 2016.
We're trying to imagine what it would be like in New York City if we could grow food in public space. And what if the New York City Parks Department could not only allow people to harvest food from their parks, but actually cultivate spaces where New Yorkers could get involved in the landscape that they're part of. We're trying to talk about food access and food sovereignty and what it means to build a resilient community of plants, of people, and of other life forms that that take into account what people for generations have called all kinds of things, including permaculture or permanent culture or permanent agriculture. The principles of these things have to do with caring for the earth, caring for the people, and sharing, really just like sharing the yield. Whatever you have, don't just take it for yourself, but actually give it away. Give it to someone else.
No plant is a bad plant, right?
No plant is a bad plant,
but this one is not as good as others, and it's taking up a lot of room, and it spreads like crazy. This is called Lady's Thumb, and it will produce these tiny little pink seeds, which will go everywhere. So we try to get rid of it, yes.
We don't get rid of it, per se. I mean, we're going to turn it into compost eventually. These plants are opportunists. So we're kind of trying to capitalize on their opportunity to help us make compost.
That's right. We definitely don't have unlimited space here, and we have a lot of different plant varieties, so we don't want this one taking over everything.
Swale began as an idea. It was kind of something that came about after Mary Mattingly, an artist, a sculptor, and a social sculptor, and also a public artist, was working on a project called Water Pod, and that project was docked in the South Bronx at Concrete Plant Park. And a young person who came on board of that on that project, which was a little more about artists living in community with each other. They had some chickens, they had food growing, and they had studios and living space on the barge. So people would come on board and sort of learn about the systems they were using there. And so a young person had this idea that was, what if you had another barge and it just had food on it and you could bring it to the Bronx and feed all the people here? And so that was the seed that started this idea of creating a barge that would actually just be a space where food was growing.
And why was it needed in the Bronx?
Concrete Plant Park is just north of Hunts Point Market, which is the largest wholesale food distributor in the country, I believe. But also, it's a wholesale distributor, so people can't actually shop there that live in that neighborhood. Also, some of the highest asthma rates for people in New York City are in the South Bronx due to trucks idling, dropping food off. It's also home to one of the largest wastewater treatment plants in the city. So it's a community where there are a lot of food insecure people. And bringing fresh access to fresh vegetables and fresh produce, fresh fruits, became really important to us and our community partners in that neighborhood as well. So we worked very closely with the Bronx River Alliance, with Youth Ministries for Peace and Justice, and the New York City Parks Department in the South Bronx. And it's actually pretty exciting. There's a lot of energy around building a land-based foodway project there in that park as part of the Bronx River Greenway.
Is it the Bronx or the South Bronx that's been declared a food desert?
Yeah, so the South Bronx, and I don't know about the Bronx at large, but definitely the South Bronx is one of the largest food deserts in America. which is kind of a conundrum due to all of these foods coming through that neighborhood, but no one can touch them. And a food desert is a place, a neighborhood where access to fresh vegetables, fresh produce, and fresh fruits is hard to come by. It's either cost prohibitive or it just is not around. Here we're approaching Swales Berm. So the berm is adjacent to the swale. So the berm is kind of a hill that provides shelter and height for plants that need deeper root space. And the swale is the deep depression in the soil where nutrients and water collect. So it's a place where things, runoff happens, and from that comes new life. So the swale can be found on the other side of the berm, often. It's a common landscape term, but also the name of our project here. So we're really, we tried to be this platform where lots of things are cross-pollinating and collecting, and new growth and new collaborations can come from that.
Originally, this barge was used for hauling sand. So it was built with a team of volunteers in the spring of 2016, laying down... I think we start with what's on the bottom layer.
There's some barrier, kind of like a weed barrier, but also like a leveling. We did a lot of leveling of this barge. It has an undulating surface, and so actually, it's also porous. So part of what we're doing here on Swale is trying to recycle our water. Mm-hmm. So water rainfalls and permeates the surface of the barge, and then we actually pump it back up into the garden. So we're trying to create this closed-loop ecosystem where we're really using and reusing the resources over and over again.
And all these things can technically be taken by the public when they come. So do you want to explain how that works and what you can take?
Yeah, exactly. So our open hours are right now Thursday through Sunday, noon to 6. It'll be a little bit different in the Bronx, but anytime we are open to the public, people are welcome to come on board and try and take whatever they like for free. So that's sort of our proposal, part of what we're trying to challenge, you know, some of the common notions of like the plight of the commons, and offering this as a space for everyone to be a communally cared for.
And how is that allowed, like health and safety wise, regulatory? Is that to do with the Parks Department law?
Yeah, so in New York City, there is an ordinance that prohibits growing or foraging, picking food on public land. Part of that came out of the creation of public parks in the late 1800s, like Central Park and Prospect Park. Some concern with people disrupting the landscape that was created there. And then also, understandably, concerns with some of the soil contamination in New York.
So sometimes I like to give people the weeds of Swale tour. It's where we talk about plants that are volunteers here in the space. So we have a good amount of plants that have found us through either our soil, through pollinating, through our wind pollination, and or just seeds that have found us here. So here we've got one of my favorite plants like this called Lamb's Quarters, which is actually a native plant to this region of the Eastern Seaboard in New York State. And it's not only a leafy green vegetable, but a grain as well. It's in the same family as quinoa.
Wow. Can you describe what it looks like?
Yeah, so it has this, it's called Lamb's Quarters. It gets its namesake for its leaf, the shape of which is shaped like the hindquarters of a lamb.
Oh, I can see that.
So you can kind of see it's almost like hoof-like.
Yeah.
But it's a little fuzzy on the back. It has kind of like a, almost like a grainy texture, soft, that kind of peels away when you touch it, but it's super high in calcium, and I believe vitamin D.
I always need calcium. Thank you very much. Yes.
So. You can find it at your local farmer's market sometimes.
Definitely.
For a high price. Delicacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm, that's great. It's kind of bitter, but in a nice way.
Mm-hmm.
Would balance out some sweet salad produce as well.
Absolutely.
What would you use it in?
So I would use this in a salad.
Mm-hmm.
You could also kind of just like stir fry it a little bit, or just cook it down with some garlic, maybe a little bit of onions or shallots, and throw it on some pasta.
education is a huge part of SWAIL, and you're in charge of schools or educational programs. What do you do that involves school children?
Yeah, so we welcome groups from all kinds of organizations to come out to SWAIL, and we do some service-based learning with them. So we're really all about hands-on learning. We give very active, engaged plant tours, making people taste things, and then usually do some kind of a workshop, either based in arts. So we've done some weaving workshops. We've done workshops using plants as natural dye for cloth. And then we also just, we get in hands dirty, getting kids in the soil. So we turn compost. We talk about native landscapes. We talk about permaculture and why it's important. And we really try to have fun.
And are you ever surprised by what the kids know or don't know?
So I'm always surprised how much kids know. And their instincts are usually correct, right? Like you they pick things up and they're like, can I eat this? Really? Can I eat this flower? And then they try it, and sometimes they're surprised that it tastes so good or so bad or whatever. And but they're willing to try things, which is always super exciting. And a lot of them are either know about plants from school. They're doing a great job in public schools right now, actually, in New York City. There's a lot of sustainability coordinators trying to talk about plants and recycling and gardening and how do we bring these things into the classroom. And we're really trying to jump on that with SWAIL and both bring school groups out here, but also hopefully at some point bring what we have to schools directly.
Because a lot of these children also won't have gardens, right? That's a rare occurrence in New York for the majority of children, right?
Absolutely.
So learning about it somewhere is vital.
Absolutely. And, you know, like we encourage people to come back, to come visit us on SWAIL, and we love volunteers. We love volunteers of all ages who want to just come and hang out and eat some plants and help to teach others about plants. So that's another thing that I really try to instill in young people is you can be teachers too.
How's the whole project funded?
Very good question. The project actually started with a grant from an organization called A Blade of Grass, which supports politically active, community, I guess, centered art initiatives and artists.
Socially engaged.
Socially engaged, yeah, exactly. So Mary submitted a proposal to them for SWAIL and got a seed grant from them. And then we did a successful Kickstarter after that.
And how can people listening to this support SWAIL?
It's also a great question.
Yeah.
We're currently doing an Indiegogo campaign, another sort of crowdfunding platform. Right now, we are partnered with NYFA, New York Foundation for the Arts, as our physical conduit. So if you go on our website, you can donate there. So that's really, right now, that's critically important to us.
It's how we stay afloat.
It's how we stay afloat. We have a sponsor with a hard cider company called Strongbow, which is helping us this year. But aside from that, we're figuring it out. Right here, we're looking at a mint plant. Mm-hmm. I think this is peppermint, right?
Chocolate mint.
So every plant in the mint family is distinguished by its unique stem formation, which is a square shape. You can see here.
Oh, I've never seen that. That's wonderful.
We have a lot of different varieties of mint on board. I've heard different numbers. What, like 6, 7?
Probably, yeah.
At least. Mm-hmm. So this is chocolate mint. Wow. You can smell it.
It's so fragrant.
Mm. Very chocolate forward.
Mm-hmm. Part of what we're doing here is an alternative, right? Mm. Like, what does it mean to be an alternative to ... So we've been looking a little bit into alternative economic models. Mm-hmm. What does it look like for SWAIL to be a cooperative for outdoor educators? What does it look like for SWAIL to be a place for artists to come and do seed projects or collaborate on building out our water filtration system or helping to paint a mural or, you know, any number of things? Also teaching workshops. We're super open to having people on board to teach us and teach other people. So it's really an open, collaborative platform. And we're trying to foster that community so that we can all grow and kind of like push the edges and the limits of what we see as possible for something like a nonprofit to do in New York City.
And lastly, what's your favorite place time and place to be on soil?
Always, but also
I know yours.
The evenings. It starts to get a little cooler, kind of after 5 p.m. The sun starts to go down a little bit. It's a great time for weeding or planting, watering, but also then you get the golden hour to really kind of close out your day.
Yeah. I also like the golden hour. But I think during weekdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, being on board is a really nice time because it's not as busy, so you get a little bit more individual FaceTime with the people coming on, get to know them personally, and you know, get to ask them how they found out about us, why they're here, do personalized tour. I really like that. Mm. You know, we have people who have heard about us on social media coming from Bed-Stuy. I had a mom and daughter who was homeschooled come from, I think, Red Hook. She had a little garden in her backyard, but wanted to sort of come and learn more here. They came with a little Tupperware container, which was really nice.
We've had school groups come from New Jersey and Staten Island and in the Bronx, and people really, they really find us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We're super psyched about.
Yeah, it's been really great.
People want to get involved in all these wonderful parts of Swale. Everywhere. They want to volunteer, donate. Tell us everywhere we can find you.
Yeah, you can find us on the internet at swaleny.org. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm. All the platforms.
And that's all at swaleny.
At swaleny. Or at swale project as well. We have a couple of different... a couple of different handles.
Yeah.
We're a group of many people, so you know it's a lot of folks are take the helm at different times. So it's an interesting social experiment, also how to manage a project of such large britches with as it grows with a team of growing volunteers, and also now we're starting to have some staff members, so which is super exciting.
That's wonderful, Marissa, Lindsay. Thank you so much for being on Radio Cherubim.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Hester Kant, the Swale team, and Kara and Nathan from Roads and Kingdoms. Thanks, as always, to our engineer Dave Tadashore, and much love to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. As always, we'd like to say a big thank you to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Ariel Lauren Wilson, and I'm the editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is bomb? Food tech entrepreneur Jennifer Goggin. In a male-dominated field, she's launched multiple companies that build local and sustainable food systems. We need more like her.